From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take 2, me Martinez. Some Southern California congressional seat races are still tight. We'll hear about what districts are poised to flip. Plus, former Dodgers executive Kim Ng has made history as she's now Major League Baseball's first female general manager. We'll hear from the person who gave Ng her first job in baseball, former Dodgers GM Dan Evans. It's all ahead on Take 2. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take 2. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for joining us. Coming up. That's right, the bats of Los Angeles. Now, that's the sound of the Western Red Bat, to be specific. I mean, they're all over the city, probably roosting in your backyard even. But fear not, they're actually really good for our environment. We're going to get into that in just a bit. But we kick things off, as we do every single Friday, with State of Affairs. That's our weekly look at politics in the Golden State, where the dust still has yet to settle. And with us today, Libby Denkman, KPCC senior politics reporter. Also with us, Jack Pitney, Roy P. Crocker, professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College. And we're going to start, guys, in our own backyard here, where several congressional races are still undecided. Libby, you've been following the contest in District 25, the razor-thin margin there. That's Democrat Katie Hill's former seat representing people in North LA County. What's the latest?
Yeah, you have to have a microscope or a magnifying glass to see this margin. A Mike Garcia, the Republican incumbent who won in the special election on May 12th to take that seat, which was formerly held by Katie Hill, who flipped it from the Republican to the Democratic column in 2018. Garcia retook his lead over the Democrat Assemblywoman Christy Smith, but he's only up by 219 votes, and a big drop of ballots is expected today from LA County, which have been trending more towards Christy Smith. The Ventura County votes tend to favor Garcia. So, I mean, such a close margin in this one, and it shows that this North LA County, Eastern Ventura seat is still extremely purple, despite a pretty healthy Democratic voter registration advantage.
I wonder if they're both on the edge of their seats, Libby, just kind of roiling seeing how this thing is going. I can't imagine.
It must be awful.
Being in their shoes, yeah. Now, okay, so Orange County now, incumbent Democrat Harley Ruta conceded his race against Republican Michelle Steele earlier this week, but the congressional contest between incumbent Democrat Gil Cisneros and GOP challenger Young Kim, that one's still in the air as well. Libby, where does that one stand?
This one has not been called, although Young Kim seems to have a fairly stable lead. She now is ahead by about 4,000 votes over incumbent Gil Cisneros. And this seat, it combines a slice of San Bernardino. It's in the north part of Orange County and then also part of LA County. So you have to wait until each county's ballot reports come in, and the different counties, just like in the 25th district, favor different candidates. But Young Kim's lead looks to be a fairly healthy for what is still a very close race. And it appears that she will be flipping that seat back to the Republican column, barring just a huge number of outstanding ballots that go towards Cisneros. But mathematically, it is getting really difficult for him to catch her.
Jack Pitney, yesterday we spoke with Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff. He's still trying to figure out, based on the popular vote, why Americans voted out Donald Trump but leaned toward Republicans in local races. These districts that we're talking about were once red. They shifted blue, now inching back to red. What do you make of all this, Jack?
Well, it's a cliche that it all comes down to turnout, but in this case, that's true. And we'll have a clearer picture when all the votes are in, but one thing's clear. In 2018, Republicans really didn't have that much reason to turn out. Governor's race was a real snoozer. Everybody knew right from the start Gavin Newsom was going to win, and he won by a record-setting margin. In the Senate race, you had two Democrats. You had Dianne Feinstein and Kevin DeLeon. So Republicans didn't really have that much of a reason to turn out. 2020, very different. Presidential race, everybody saw high stakes. Republicans turned out, Democrats turned out. And this time, it was much more of an even fight. And we see this reflected in these very close races.
Is this, Jack, how it works when a district is going through a change? Say they've been one way for a while, and then there seems to be a change in the way people want to vote. Does it go through these stages where it goes from one to the other and then solidly turns one color going forward?
Yeah, right now we're in the knife edge phase. The parties are pretty evenly divided. I suspect over time the Democrats are going to get stronger because of ethnic change, though that isn't absolutely locked in. If you look at the Hispanic vote in Texas, for instance, Trump did surprisingly well. Could Republicans repeat that feat in California? We'll just have to wait and see.
Now, because of all this, Joe Biden now has a slimmer margin of allies in the House. I mean, while control of the Senate has yet to be decided, two races in Georgia heading to a final vote, a runoff in early January. Jack, what do you think this means for what Biden can or can't accomplish once he takes office, especially with the coronavirus and the economy?
Well, there are certain things that both parties have an incentive to work on. They both have an incentive to deal with coronavirus. Make sure you get the vaccine out. President Trump had his press conference on that today. They also don't want to have a second dip in the recession. So eventually, we're going to have another COVID relief bill. So far, so good. But when it comes to major presidential initiatives, I don't think Biden is going to be able to achieve much of the progressive agenda. You can't have a great society or a New Deal, much less a Green New Deal, in a 50-50 Senate.
Libby Denkman, as we talk here, there's still a swath of people who say the election was stolen. Election observers elsewhere have said there's no sign of massive fraud. But at least in California, what have officials said about the security of the vote here in California?
Things went incredibly smoothly here. There is no evidence of widespread fraud, even pockets of fraud that have been reported. No evidence of that. In large part, that's because of the widespread adoption of vote by mail, which California expanded to everyone for the pandemic. The LA County Board of Supervisors congratulated Registrar Dean Logan earlier this week on his successful navigation of this election in the middle of COVID. He announced that the county will also be continuing to send ballots to everyone in the mail for future elections. And you may have seen a tweet from the president that showed a video of election workers picking up ballots from an LA County drop box. That was allegedly somebody had been, you know, catching these election workers in some type of fraud. Well, the registrar has debunked this, that it's normal procedure for county election workers to lock the ballot drop boxes at 8 p.m. on election day, and then they wait until the next day to actually empty those boxes. People cannot cast ballots late after 8 p.m. It's just normal procedure. So by and large, people voted in person and they went early when they did that. And then a huge number of people voted by mail. And it was just a huge turnaround from the long lines in March.
And Libby, generally, nationally, things went smoothly everywhere, too. And you were on the show with me a bunch of times. We were always leaving the possibility open for something going wrong somewhere. I almost feel bad for even bringing it up.
Well, I think that the problem with bringing it up, too, is that you sort of have to amplify, say, the, you know, misleading tweets from the president in order to debunk those. And we as journalists always have to walk that line between, raising the profile of conspiracy theories in order to debunk them or just ignoring them altogether. But then they can proliferate online. So certainly it's one of those, darned if you do, darned if you don't.
Jack, I think we know President Trump, we know him enough to know that he'll probably never accept what outside observers say. So now we're dealing with an issue of a peaceful transfer of power, something that, to my knowledge, no other president has had to face, at least not in my lifetime. What do you see happening to the tone of American politics when Donald Trump is eventually out of office but still has a platform on, say, cable news or his Twitter account?
Well, don't expect immediate healing. Joe Biden is not a miracle worker. Polls showed that there's a lot of partisan animosity, not just among the elites, but at the grassroots. You look at the polls, a lot of Republicans and Democrats see each other not just as mistaken on the issues, but as downright evil. And that's why turnout was so high this year. It's only a little bit of an exaggeration to say that Democrats thought Republicans would bring fascism and Republicans thought Democrats would bring socialism. And people saw high stakes. That's why they turned out in record numbers. All that said, at least Biden can avoid making things worse. At least he's not going to put gasoline on the fire. And that's something.
We're talking State of Affairs with Jack Pitney, the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College, and also with us Libby Denkman, KPCC Senior Politics Reporter. Now, looking inside of Joe Biden's team, VP-elect Kamala Harris will move on from the U.S. Senate. That means Governor Gavin Newsom here in California gets to appoint her replacement. Libby, you've been reporting out about who might take her place. So what factors does Gavin Newsom have to consider here?
The governor is going to take into account, of course, experience and policy positions. He'll want somebody in his, Democratic mold. But he also has to think about who Harris is and what she represents. She's this barrier-busting Black and Indian woman, a child of immigrant parents, and she's the first female and a woman of color to boot vice president. Groups from different wings of the Democratic Party in California right now are lobbying the governor hard to see her seat filled by someone who will embody a similar step forward in representation at the highest levels of government. Latino leaders say that it's time for the first Latinx senator from California, where roughly 40% of the population identifies as Latino. Names that rise to the top of that list are Attorney General Javier Becerra and Secretary of State Alex Padilla. But I spoke to Zenaida Huerta, who just graduated from Claremont McKenna and is part of the LA County Democratic Party's Central Committee. She really thinks a Latina should get this seat.
I believe it's time for a Latina to serve as the next senator for California. Latina voters have been critical in deciding elections, and yet somehow they're disproportionately underrepresented in elected office.
And Huerta says she's pushing for Nanette Barragan, an attorney who was elected to Congress in 2016. She represents San Pedro, Carson, parts of Compton. But there are also a lot of Black leaders who say Harris needs to be replaced by another Black woman. I also talked to law student Haley Taylor Schlitz, who wrote an op-ed about this for The Griot. She said Newsom needs to think about Inauguration Day 2021, when Harris raises her hand to become vice president. There will be no Black women left in the Senate.
At that exact moment, we lose our only voice in the Senate. We're once again voiceless and voteless in the Senate. And that's not acceptable. And that's not something that we as Black women across the country should be okay with.
So most of all, I think the post-Harris vacancy is really sharpening attention on how little diversity there is in the Senate. It's just still overwhelmingly white and male. So every opening creates this rush to try to increase representation.
And Libby, Newsom's got to be thinking about his own political future, I would imagine.
Oh, of course. And, you know, Harris's rise to the White House really closes off what a lot of folks assumed he was going to do in the future, which was run for president. Kamala will be seen as the next Californian in line, certainly for that job. So the question is, will he be looking at, say, Dianne Feinstein's seat in a few years when she's up for re-election? And will his choice for the second seat, the seat that's open right now, will that choice help him or hurt him as he's looking at his next campaign?
Jack, one more thing on Kamala Harris's replacement and Gavin Newsom's thought process. Do you think there's any added incentive to maybe choose Padilla or Becerra, not necessarily because they are Latino, but because then he would get to choose the next Secretary of State and then or the next Attorney General? So he would get two positions to fill with one move.
Yeah, because the other position could be a make good with whatever constituency is unhappy with his previous choice. And by the way, I got to say, I was thrilled to hear my advisees, Zenaida Huerta, just a minute ago.
Oh, I didn't realize. That's so cool, Jack. Yes. I love that.
Yeah, and I certainly wouldn't want to get into an argument with Zenaida. But but anyway, yeah, I think with somebody like Padilla, you've got number one, he's a longstanding ally of Newsom, Southern California. He's won statewide. I think he would bring a lot to the table, so he would be very high on the list.
Now, Jack, if those two close senatorial races in Georgia leads to an even split between parties in the Senate, that means Harris's role becomes even more important because she'll be the one to break any ties. How do you see her playing out her role in a very sharply divided Senate if it comes to this?
Well, we have a precedent for the first half of 2001. That's the exact condition the Senate was in, 50-50. Then Vice President Cheney had to stay very close to Capitol Hill in case there was ever a tie vote, and he had to step in to break that tie. Harris will be similarly limited, which is inconvenient for her because she has the ambitions beyond the vice presidency. That now, said,
oh, go ahead, yeah, go ahead, Jack.
That said, she can also be an ambassador to the Senate, particularly the less senior senators who did not serve with Biden.
Now, Libby, there have been rumors all over the place about other posts in Biden's cabinet that could be filled with some notable Californians. So what can you tell us about where that stands?
Sure. So that could also play into the calculation for, you know, where the musical chairs go in terms of the Senate race. So the conversation has circled around Javier Becerra as being a potential choice for the Justice Department or DHS, which would be, a push towards looking for California values at DHS, expanded immigrant rights and change in how we enforce laws at the border. Of course, Mayor Garcetti, Eric Garcetti is rumored for transportation. Karen Bass, potential for housing and urban development. All of these are speculative. This is, reporting from people who are getting, unnamed sources to talk about this. So take that for what it is. Yeah. Jimmy Gomez is somebody who has been talked about for U.S. Trade Representative. Julie Sue, Secretary of the California Labor and Workforce Development Agency, is somebody who's been rumored for the Labor Department, although Bernie Sanders is also in the mix for that. So we'll see. And then Mary Nichols, who's the chair of the Air Resources Board in California, is a name that's popped up for EPA.
Jack, if more Californians are part of the White House, I mean, it would be definitely a notable change from how the Trump White House sees California, how he's treated our state, kind of a political punching bag there. What kind of benefits might we see with a new relationship, and are they far from guaranteed?
Well, I think one thing that's pretty likely is that on issues such as immigration and the environment, it's a lot less likely that California will be at odds with the federal government in court. Javier Becerra won't be suing as much, particularly if he's either the Attorney General or Secretary of Homeland Security. The sides will change. And that's the most practical outcome. The legal conflict between California and the federal government is going to be dialed down dramatically.
If these musical chairs, if they do work out the way some people think, will we have like a power vacuum here in California? I mean, we're dealing with a lot right now. The economy, homelessness, housing, Jack. I mean, I think this is when we need the leaders, not we don't need them to leave.
Well, that is potentially a problem, but it's likely that the vacuum would be filled pretty quickly. Let's say Javier Becerra goes to D.C. as either Attorney General or DHS. Plenty of well-qualified Democrats who'd be very happy to accept appointment as Attorney General. After all, that's how Becerra got the job in the first place himself. One thing is, problem for the Democrats is Biden has to be careful about picking currently serving members of the House of Representatives. A lot of Democrats would like to see Katie Porter get a big job. That's not going to happen because if Katie Porter goes to the cabinet, that seat is vacant, and Republicans could very well pick that up in a special election.
One more thing, Libby. This week, California passed a grim benchmark, 1 million coronavirus cases since all of this began. Libby, what's the latest from the governor on what he's trying to get under control?
Well, you just heard Austin Cross talk about this in newscast before the show started. Newsom joined Washington and Oregon governors in issuing a travel advisory for Californians. He's asking people to stay local, especially during this holiday season, avoid non-essential travel, and he wants people who come in from out of state to quarantine for 14 days. He said in a statement that, increased cases are adding pressure on our hospital systems and threatening the lives of seniors, essential workers, and vulnerable people across the state. But, at the same time, Newsom has been caught up in a bit of a scandal. He and his wife attended a birthday party on November 6th for a longtime advisor at the French Laundry, a very fancy restaurant outside in Napa. And there were at least 12 people at this dinner, which violated a three household limit in state guidelines for gatherings. So a lot of folks are saying Newsom is basically exhibiting the do as I say, not as I do ethos.
It's the French Laundry. It it's French Laundry.
Hey, I know.
I know. My position on this has been very clear, but it's French Laundry. Okay,
Just go with fewer than three households, and you'll enjoy the food even more without a side of COVID.
Libby Dekman, KPCC senior politics reporter, Jack Pitney, Roy P. Crocker, professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College. My thanks to you both. More Take Two coming up in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Let's take a look now at how police are feeling in the wake of the summer protests over the killing of George Floyd. The union that represents rank-and-file LAPD officers has compiled what appears to be the first survey of cops since the explosion of rage on the streets of Southern California. KPCC's criminal justice correspondent Frank Stoltz is here with the results. Frank, what are the most important findings?
Well, first off, a lot of cops are mad at Chief Michael Moore and his command staff. Nearly 90% of those who responded felt Moore failed to provide strong leadership during the unrest. Many said the command staff was unprepared for the protests and would not allow officers to defend themselves when rocks and bottles were thrown at them. This is interesting, A, because, of course, many protesters accused the LAPD of using excessive force and have filed a class action lawsuit. Many officers commented they were encouraged that Moore was on the ground during the first few days of the protest, but the majority called him a politician for, in their eyes, supporting protesters.
How do they feel like Chief Moore supported protesters? That doesn't sound make sense.
Right. He wasn't exactly carrying a banner with the protesters. Many officers were particularly perturbed by the chief's decision to kneel with a group of people demonstrating in the Fairfax district. Here's Union President Craig Lally.
By the chief kneeling, he lost the confidence of the police officers, because we know that if you give Black Lives Matter, defund the police an inch, they're going to want a mile. They hate you anyways.
So the survey found officers were angry over Moore's pandering to politicians and to groups like BLM. And yes, some officers said the chief pandered to Antifa. It's important to note, A, that the survey was far from scientific. About 2,700 of the department's 10,000 officers responded.
Okay. Now, how did the chief respond?
Well, he seemed to acknowledge that they're partially right, not about the Antifa stuff, but in a statement to officers, Moore said he believed he had done the right thing during the protest, but wished he could do some things differently. He did not specify what. And he said he was committed to doing a better job as chief. Now, it's interesting, one ex-LAPD sergeant I talked to, Cheryl Dorsey, was not so kind toward her ex-colleagues' concerns.
Police officers, some of them, are like incorrigible children, and they don't like to be disciplined by their parents, being Chief Michael Moore.
So not unlike journalists, I suppose,
Yeah.
But, you know, I should note it's unclear how many officers face formal discipline for their behavior during the unrest. As of September, 55 had been accused of excessive force. Four actually referred to the DA's office for possible criminal charges, according to a department spokesman.
So, Frank, what's the political significance of this survey then? I mean, it comes as the city defunds the LAPD by, what, $150 million?
Yeah, that cut really rattled the police union, which for decades has enjoyed really kind of unrivaled power in city politics, with its battle cry always in the name of public safety. Now the union is facing strong opposition from reformers. This survey should be taken in that context. It is a message not just to the chief, but to the city's political leadership that a significant number of officers are not happy. But we should note, Loyola Law School professor Eric Miller, who studies policing, says this is not just about unhappiness with the chief.
What we're seeing is a call for a radically different style of policing and resistance from police officers.
So in a sense, this survey is that resistance, right?
Yeah.
You know, one part of the survey found that half the LAPD's respondents ranked morale at the lowest possible rank. One clear takeaway is that maintaining morale during what many hope will be a period of radical change in policing, maintaining that morale is going to be hard.
What about the sheriff's department? How's the morale over there?
Well, the union that represents LA sheriff's deputies has not conducted such a survey, but its executive director said the department's rank and file generally seem satisfied with how Sheriff Alex Villanueva has handled the unrest or handled the unrest. In one example, deputies wanted more barricades, for instance, and they got them. Notably, Villanueva never offered an olive branch and took a knee with protesters like Moore did. I should note the sheriff's department also faces a class action lawsuit over alleged excessive force during the unrest, just like the LAPD. But union executive director Derek Hsu, says deputies feel they are being unfairly portrayed in the media, and that is hurting morale.
It's really challenging to come home to your family and know that they've watched the news where leaders in the community and other people have chastised the profession.
And one last note, in the LAPD survey, nearly 40% of officers said they were thinking of leaving the department for another police agency after this summer's unrest. The union leader said that should be worrisome. Former Sergeant Dorsey, who we heard from earlier, said maybe it would be an opportunity to hire a whole new cadre of cops who are more compassionate and empathetic towards the communities they police.
That's KPCC's criminal justice correspondent, Frank Stoltz. Frank, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ed.
All right, moving on. Life under President Trump has been turbulent for many young immigrants without legal status. Since 2017, no one new has been allowed to apply for DACA, the program that shields many young immigrants from deportation. Now that Joe Biden is president-elect, how is the DACA community feeling about the future? KPCC's Josie Huang has more.
Sharon Monica says the week of the election, she barely slept.
For like undocumented folks, it was just like extra nerve-wracking.
Monica was brought here by her parents from Indonesia when she was four and has depended on DACA for almost 5 years. Not just to keep her from being deported, but to allow her to work so she can attend UC Irvine. She worried about losing all of that under Trump. Even though she supported Bernie Sanders, she's relieved that Biden won.
Biden's not the best candidate, but I just know I feel a lot better than I did like 4 years ago.
Biden was vice president in 2012 when President Obama introduced DACA, short for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Until Biden outlines his plans, a lot of uncertainty still surrounds the program, like how often people must renew. The Trump administration made it every year instead of every 2 years as in the past. Luis Perez directs legal services for the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of LA.
What we would like to see is for him to say that on day one, he's going to bring DACA back to what it was in 2012, meaning that it will be for 2 years and that folks will be able to apply for the first time.
Perez has urged people with expiring DACA documents to renew rather than wait to hear more from Biden. As for Monica, she's ready for the national conversation to progress and focus on expanding rights not just for DACA recipients like her, but all immigrants without status. I'm Josie Huang.
And tune in to Take Two next Thursday, the 19th, when we'll devote a full hour to how immigration policies in the U.S., especially those targeting legal immigration, have changed under the Trump administration and what might be done under a Biden administration to reverse those changes. More Take Two coming up. Stay with us. Dum do dum do be do dum 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 do dum do be do dum dum. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. All right, with all the news around the COVID-19 pandemic this year, bats have been getting a bad rap. But if you ask the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles, they'll tell you that bats in Southern California aren't so terrible. They provide a lot of ecological benefits, and they're more widespread in dense urban LA than you might think. For years, the museum has been building up a project to study bats in LA County, and recently they've called on Angelenos to help them out through the Backyard Bat Survey. For more on this, we're joined now by Miguel Ordeñana, Community Science Manager and leader of the Backyard Bat Survey at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. Miguel, remind us how the Backyard Bat Survey started and why.
Yeah, so previous to my project, there had been a lot of bat research on the outskirts of LA in the San Gabriel Mountains, and then a few more recently in Griffith Park, and then in the Baldwin Hills. And so I thought people are finding bats, and including myself, in places that are kind of a stretch for people to think of as places for bats. Then I was like, okay, if we're finding them there, what about South Los Angeles? And so because I work at the Natural History Museum, we had this new garden called the Nature Gardens. And so we installed an acoustic detector, which is a device that uses a recording device to capture the species-specific calls of bats. They're also known as echolocation, so ultrasonic sound that bats use to navigate in space, to communicate with each other, and to hunt. And by recording this information, we're able to tell what bats are in certain areas and which weren't. And so to take it a step further, we wanted to turn this into a community science project, which is a project where scientists like myself partner with community members to answer real-world questions that are relevant not just to the scientific community, but also to the general public. And so we wanted to know where bats were. And because bats are this controversial species.
Regrettably so, right, Miguel? I mean, they shouldn't be that controversial, right? Especially not in the way that 2020 has made them controversial.
You're exactly right. They provide extreme benefits and ecological services to all environments, including urban environments, because they eat the most deadly animal in the world, which is the mosquito. Mosquitoes kill more people than any other species around the world because of the diseases that they carry. And so by bats being these predators of mosquitoes and eating multiple species of mosquitoes, they are able to keep this population of mosquitoes in check to some extent. And then also they eat agricultural pests that can cause over $3.5 billion of damage to our crops every year. And so they're saving us money. They're keeping us safe and less annoyed by mosquitoes. And so we should be celebrating that. And a lot of fear has gone around because of the COVID-19, but there aren't any bats that have been detected with COVID-19 in North America.
Good, good.
So that's really not a concern. We're probably more dangerous to them than they are to us.
Tell us, what has this survey been telling you about bats in LA? What kind of bats? Where do you find them? How are they behaving?
Well, we know from previous surveys that there have been 19 species of bats detected in the LA County region. But as far as the urban core, we've been able to detect 12 species of bats in backyards alone. And that's really exciting because we didn't even know if we'd find more than one species, because there are some species that are more adaptable to the city than others by being able to roost in urban structures like overpasses, people's roofs, other species that only roost in trees. And so we were able to detect not only the urban adapted species that we were hopeful to get, but other species that we didn't think we'd get at all. And so that includes four species of special concern in the state of California. And so these bats are showing that they're more resilient than we thought. And it doesn't take a huge, expansive open space to keep them around. As long as we provide little chunks of green space, whether they're a community garden or someone's backyard that provides habitat for their food, which are insects, they have a chance. And we want them to have a chance out here in LA.
We're speaking with Miguel Ordeñana, Community Science Manager and leader of the Backyard Bat Survey at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. Make the connection for us, because it's one thing to know where the bats are. How does that help the bats? How does that help protect the bats knowing where they are?
Yeah, so our project has evolved. We're able to now take it a step further, not only knowing what bats are around, to know what neighborhoods could be places of conservation focus, but going a step further and asking people to find Ruth, whether they're urban Ruths under someone's roof or eave. Someone can notice them on a walk along the LA River, flying out of an underpass or a culvert, and also people on hikes in natural areas. You want to know where those roofs are as well. And by knowing that information, we can be better conservation advocates for these species and involving more diverse communities in that effort. And so by figuring out and mapping where roofs are in LA, that's a huge step forward at understanding what natural and human structures bats are relying on to be able to survive and persist here in the LA area.
I can imagine getting the community involved helps in another way. A lot of the places where bats are on private property. So it's not like, Miguel, you can just pop into someone's backyard and say, hey, there's some bats here, because, you know, someone might call the cops on you. But that's the whole point. It gives you access to areas that maybe you would not have access to.
That's exactly the point. Yeah, community science does that for us. And by collecting this data and making these discoveries alongside the community in their very personal spaces, whether it's their backyards, their local school or library, trusted community centers, they will feel invested in the wildlife that they're discovering. It's not like this, those traditional projects where scientists come into communities, collect their data and leave, and don't leave the community inspired to keep this work going and the conservation effort going. We're trying to answer questions that not only we care about, but that the community cares about. And this question about where are bats living is a question I have been getting for years as one of the most common questions from the community of where bats are living, whether they're afraid of them or excited to help them out. And by meeting people where they're at, it's just going to make us a stronger community as far as being conservation advocates for these animals.
Now, the next step of the project is to study where the bats roost. Tell us more about that and how can people get involved? What should people do if they find bats in their backyard?
Well, we want them to report it to us by emailing us at bats@nhm.org, or there's a form that they can access on our webpage. You can visit the Natural History Museum website and search backyard bats, and you'll be brought to a Google form that you can fill out and let us know what you saw. And we don't expect everybody to know what a bat roost is. So it just allows us to start that conversation and have an opportunity to follow up with you. And we don't want you to share your information on social media because we want to be protective of these bats and their roosts. And so we want you to privately share that information with us either via email or through our private Google form so we can keep these bats safe, but also at the same time, learn more about where they are and where they aren't.
There you go. To report bat roosts or a bat sighting, just email bats, that's bats@nhm.org. That's Miguel Ordeñana, Community Science Manager and leader of the Backyard Bat Survey at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. Miguel, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You know, it's been a pretty solid month of November for trailblazing women. Earlier this week on Take Two, we spoke to Emily Harrington, who made history on Yosemite's El Capitan, and you know, Kamala Harris. You know what she did, right? Well, coming up, another barrier has been broken in sports, in Major League Baseball. We'll find out what that is when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
Gotta change around here. Gotta change around here. Can't go on this way. Things gotta change around here. Say it loud.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. The sports world got a huge first today when the Miami Marlins announced they'd hired Kim Ng to be their new general manager. Ng will be the first woman and the first Asian American to hold a GM job for any of the major North American men's sports leagues. In 1998, at the age of 29, Ng was hired as assistant general manager of the New York Yankees. Then in 2001, she became assistant GM and vice president of the Los Angeles Dodgers. Dan Evans was the Dodgers general manager who hired her back then, which also happened to be when I was the host of Dodger Talk. And it was actually the second time that Evans had hired Kim Ng. He'd brought her on as an intern right out of college years earlier with the Chicago White Sox. We reached out to Kim Ng. She's going to be introduced on Monday to the folks in Miami, so hopefully we'll speak to her next week. But Dan, first, welcome to Take Two. What sort of executive skills does Kim Ng have that made you want to hire her not only once, but twice? And how will they help her as a new GM of the Marlins?
Well, first of all, hey, it's really good to talk to you again in my favorite radio station in Southern California. So I'm a happy guy. When I was living in Pasadena, I'd drive by it all
the time and smile.
I hired Kim twice, and I hired her for different reasons the two times. The first time I hired her, she's fresh out of college. She was unbelievably motivated to contribute and be a team player and be innovative, creative, and really be an immediate impact intern hire. A, she was so good. It was 2 months into her internship and I hired her full time. She was that good. 10 years later, I get the job with the Dodgers. You remember how complicated things were at that time. We were trying to rebuild a franchise, and then I needed a leader. But it was interesting. In those 10 years, she had left and gone to the Yankees, as you mentioned, and had won 3 world championships. So when she came to the Dodgers, as you remember, I was trying to add people with winning experience who could lead and get us out of that very difficult period. And that's what she brought to the table. It was an amazing transformation in a 10-year period, but candidly, it just displayed what she had in the horizon. She was going to be a really great executive, and I'm just lucky I got to spend a lot of time with her through the years.
Dan, I remember back when Kim joined the Dodgers, the big story was her gender, but I also thought her age was just as significant. I mean, in the stodgy old school world of Major League Baseball, an early 30s Chinese American woman as a high level executive. I mean, for me, that was remarkable. Did you get any pushback at the time for hiring her?
Lots and lots, and that was okay. I think, you know, I've been very lucky. I've had great mentors, great bosses in my career. And when you believe in someone, you've got to be there for them and support them and also display to everybody externally that the stigma, the issues that you may have, I didn't. I did get pushback. I think there was a stigma in the game 20 years ago. Why would a woman, an Asian American woman, be involved in baseball decisions? Why does this happen? It's funny, after about a few months, I never heard that again. Everybody knew that she was capable, qualified, talented, and respected.
Yeah.
Just, you know, she's that person. You worked with her.
Yeah.
You know what she's like. She's a special, special person. And, you know, the hurdles that she had to overcome and the stigma, I think, make the story even better. You know, she's so qualified for the job, and she happens to be an Asian American woman, the first ever to run a baseball franchise. I think it's a great story.
And the thing is, Dan, she's been qualified for a long time. In 2005, Kim interviewed for the Dodgers GM job, and she didn't get it. She stayed on as an assistant GM. But then for years, she interviewed with 4 other teams, the Mariners, Padres, Angels, and Giants, but no luck. So then she joined MLB as a senior VP for baseball ops. Dan, why do you think she could not break through to a general manager's position all those years?
Well, I certainly don't think it was her qualifications, because I think they were impeccable. Her reputation, her respect in the game, her professional nature, I think those were all, she was already qualified. I think being a woman was the hurdle, and I think it took somebody with guts to shatter that ceiling. They broke the glass today. I give the Marlins tremendous credit. Hey, listen, it's a big day for the game. It's a big day for sports in general. It's a big day for society. When we've got a vice president-elect who's also an Indian-American woman and Kim in the same week and a half, I think it's a sign of really positive things. And I think for everybody out there, you know, there's a whole generation of young women who finally have somebody who looks like them in a capacity in baseball. We've never had that. And I think as a result, you know, unknowingly, she's going to lead the next generation of female sports leaders for what she is, just a tremendously accomplished executive who happens to be a woman. And I think the more we talk about her skills and the less we talk about her gender, it's going to be great for everybody involved.
Dan, you know this, pro sports is still overwhelmingly an old boys' club. Just as Jackie Robinson had pressure on him for being the first black major leaguer, what kind of pressure do you think Kim Ng will feel as the first female GM?
Well, and you know, you're broadcasting from the city where Jackie Robinson learned to be the man that he later became, and just a sensational American impact story. I think as good a decision Ricky made on the player, he made an even better decision on the person, the character. And I think that's why Kim is going to be a success. Enormously qualified, unbelievably talented, but it's her character, her professionalism, and her interpersonal skills that will be the reason she succeeds. And hey, listen, you and I have never, you know, grown up with the pressures that she's going to have as an Asian American woman, the first one in that role. You know, we just don't feel that. We haven't been in her shoes. But I think to have a person of her character and her respect and her level of human is going to be such a critical ingredient for her to be successful. So there's a second and a third woman in that position. That first person, that one that breaks the barrier, has an enormous amount of pressure. And I'm really happy that they picked the right person.
That's former Dodgers general manager Dan Evans. You can follow him on Twitter at DanEvans108. Dan, thanks a lot.
Hey, great talking to you again.
And finally, it's Friday, which means it's time for Weekend Preview.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran. And A. Martinez, we've been saying it for months, there are plenty of ways to have a great weekend in Southern California while staying safe and socially distant from others. And with a record number of COVID cases happening, that's more important than ever.
Perfect. So what can I do to forget about things for a while without drinking alcohol?
Well, you can have a laugh, courtesy of the famous improv comedy troupe in WeHo, the Groundlings. Today through Sunday, it hosts the 4th annual Diversity Festival. This is where alums and special guests who happen to be POCs will perform and host classes so you can yes and with the best of them. Stars include Randall Park, Roxana Ortega, and more. It's all online, shows are free, while workshops and panels are $10 each.
All right, Leo, now holidays right around the corner. So what's not just a good way to shop for presents, but also a great way to shop locally with small businesses right here in LA?
Yeah, craft fairs, I really think, are a great way to do that. Usually they're in person, but starting this Sunday, one of them moves online. It's Virtual Kokoro 2020. This is a fair organized by the Japanese American National Museum, and it kind of doubles as a fundraiser for them. The way it works is that they're actually going to do it QVC style. They have a video you can watch to see a showcase of the small local vendors it usually hosts in person. Then afterwards, you can browse through an online catalog of those vendors and their wares so you can get them shipped directly to your door. You can also feel good that your purchase is going to benefit the museum's education programs. That's going to be online starting this Sunday through the end of the month.
And that's not just the only craft fair, right?
Right. Avoid all the shopping crowds by staying online because several LA institutions are hosting holiday markets too. So, for example, tomorrow and Sunday, the Autry Museum also hosts a craft fair, the 30th annual American Indian Arts Marketplace. So in addition to picking out gifts of art, jewelry, and fashion for your loved ones, you can watch pre-recorded talks from Indigenous directors and also get a virtual tour of the museum's exhibit, When I Remember, I See Red. This is an exhibit where you'll be able to see how Native artists use their works for politics. When you attend, it's all online and it's free. Now, there are still a bunch more events to go to without ever leaving your home. Find out what you can do this weekend by heading to our site, laist.com. That's laist.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at Leo Has a Cat.
That's KPCC's Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
Cool. Thanks, A.
while you're following Leo at Leo Has a Cat, why don't you follow Take Two at Take Two on Twitter at Take Two. I'm there as well at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. Good for Twitter and Instagram. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.